town. Look into the faces, every shade and stripe, and you're looking at the fruit of the tree. On the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down. Open up the sky, let the sun roll round. Soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life. Open up the door, take a breath of fresh air. Go digging in the dirt, see what you find there. Plant a little seed of the heirloom type, and you're growing new shoes on the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down. Open up the sky, let the sun roll round. Soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. Chilling in the shade of the tree of life. We'll be chilling in the garden, planting our seeds, hanging with the neighbors, meeting our needs, growing our freedom instead of growing our strife, watering the roots of the tree. On the tree of life. Bring on the rain, let the water roll down. Open up the sky, let the sun roll round. Soak it on up, let the fruit grow right. And we're chilling in the shade of the tree of life.
Next, we continue our ongoing reading of The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, which has occupied the second hour of the program for the last few weeks. If you've missed previous shows, you can download them online from the archive at unwelcomeguests.org. John Taylor Gatto spent 3 decades as an award-winning teacher in the New York City schools. Of that experience, he said, "Throughout most of my long career, I woke up angry in the morning, went through the school day angry, went to sleep angry at night. Anger was the fuel that drove me to spend 30 years trying to master this destructive institution." Last week, Gatto gave an account of the alarming decline of literacy in America, based on the scores of U.S. military induction tests taken by millions of young American men. Military applicants in the 1930s had a literacy rate of 98%. By the time of the Korean War, it had dropped to 81%, and by the Vietnam War, to 73%. We'll pick up where we left off in Chapter 3 of the Underground History of American Education, with the next section titled Looking Behind Appearances. Do you think class size, teacher compensation, and school revenue have much to do with education quality? If so, the conclusion is inescapable that we are living in a golden age. From 1955 to 1991, the U.S. pupil-teacher ratio dropped 40%. The average salary of teachers rose 50% in real terms, and the annual expense per pupil, inflation-adjusted, soared 350%. What other hypothesis, then, might fit the strange data I'm about to present? Forget the 10% drop in SAT and achievement test scores the press beats to death with regularity. How do you explain the 37% decline since 1972 in students who score above 600 on the SAT? This is an absolute decline, not a relative one. It is not affected by an increase in unsuitable minds taking the test, or by an increase in the numbers. The absolute body count of smart students is down drastically, with a test not more difficult than yesterday's, but considerably less so. What should be made of a 50% decline among the most rarefied group of test takers, those who score above 750? In 1972, there were 2,817 American students who reached this pinnacle. Only 1,438 did in 1994, when kids took a much easier test. Can a 50% decline occur in 22 years without signaling that some massive leveling in the public school mind is underway? In a real sense, where your own child is concerned, you might best forget scores on these tests entirely as a reliable measure of what they purport to assess. I wouldn't deny that mass movements in these scores in one direction or another indicate something is going on. And since the correlation between success in schooling and success on these tests is close, then significant score shifts are certainly measuring changes in understanding. This is a difficult matter for anyone to sort out, since many desirable occupational categories and desirable university seats even before that are reserved for those who score well. The resultant linkage of adult income with test scores then creates the illusion that these tests are separating cream from milk. But the results are rigged in advance by foreclosing opportunity to those screened out by the test. In a humble illustration, if you only let students with high scores on the language component of the SATs cut hair, eventually it would appear that verbal facility and grooming of tresses had some vital link with each other. Between 1960 and 1998, the non-teaching bureaucracy of public schools grew 500%, but oversight was concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. The 40,520 school districts with elected boards this nation had in 1960 shriveled to 15,000 by 1998. On the college rung of the school ladder, something queer was occurring too. Between 1960 and 1984, the quality of undergraduate education at America's 50 best-known colleges and universities had altered substantially. According to a 1996 report by the National Association of Scholars, these schools stopped providing, quote, broad and rigorous exposure to major areas of knowledge, quote, for the average student, even at decidedly unaverage universities like Yale and Stanford. In 1964, more than half of these institutions required a thesis or comprehensive for the bachelor's degree. By 1993, 12% did. Over the same period, the average number of classroom days fell 16%, and requirements in math, natural science, philosophy, literature, composition, and history almost vanished. Rhetoric, most potent of the active literacies, completely vanished, and a foreign language, once required at 96% of the great colleges, fell to 64%. according to the Journal of the American Medical Association of December 1995. 33% of all patients cannot read and understand instructions on how often to take medication, notices about doctor's appointments, consent forms, labels on prescription bottles, insurance forms, and other simple parts of self-care. They are rendered helpless by the inability to read. Concerning those behind the nation's prison walls, a population that has tripled since 1980, the National Center for Education Statistics stated in a 1996 report that 80% of all prisoners could not interpret a bus schedule, understand a news article or warranty instructions, or read maps, schedules, or payroll forms, nor could they balance a checkbook. 40% could not calculate the cost of a purchase. Once upon a time, we were a new nation that allowed ordinary citizens to learn how to read well and encouraged them to read anything they thought would be useful. Close reading of tough-minded writing is still the best, cheapest, and quickest method known for learning to think for yourself. This invitation to commoners extended by America was the most revolutionary pedagogy of all. Reading and rigorous discussion of that reading in a way that obliges you to formulate a position and support it against objections is an operational definition of education in its most fundamental civilized sense. No one can do this very well without learning ways of paying attention, from a knowledge of diction and syntax, figures of speech, etymology, and so on, to a sharp ability to separate the primary from the subordinate, understand allusion, master a range of modes of presentation, test truth, and penetrate beyond the obvious to the profound messages of text. Reading, analysis, and discussion are the way we develop reliable judgment, the principal way we come to penetrate covert movements behind the facade of public appearances. Without the ability to read and argue, we're just geese to be plucked. Just as experience is necessary to understand abstraction, so the reverse is true. Experience can only be mastered by extracting general principles out of the mass of details. In the absence of a perfect universal mentor, books and other texts are the best and cheapest stand-ins, always available to those who know where to look. Watching details of an assembly line or a local election unfold isn't very educational, unless you have been led in careful ways to analyze the experience. Reading is the skeleton key for all who lack a personal tutor of quality. Reading touches nothing more important than the state of mind in which you find yourself absolutely alone with the thoughts of another mind, a matchless form of intimate rapport available only to those with the ability to block out distraction and concentrate. Hence the urgency of reading well, if you read for power. Once you trust yourself to go mind to mind with great intellects, artists, scientists, warriors, and philosophers, you are finally free. In America, before we had forced schooling, an astonishing range of unlikely people knew reading was like Samson's locks, something that could help make them formidable, that could teach them their rights and how to defend those rights, could lead them toward self-determination, free from intimidation by experts. These same unlikely people knew that the power bestowed through reading could give them insight into the ways of the human heart, so they would not be cheated or fooled so easily, and that it could provide an inexhaustible store of useful knowledge, advice on how to do just about anything. By 1812, Pierre Dupont was claiming that barely 4 in 1,000 Americans were unable to read well, and that the young had skill in argumentation thanks to daily debates at the common breakfast table. By 1820, there was even more evidence of Americans' avid reading habits, when 5 million copies of James Fenimore Cooper's complex and elusive novels were sold, along with an equal number of Noah Webster's didactic Speller, to a population of dirt farmers under 20 million in size. In 1835, Richard Cobden announced that there was six times as much newspaper reading in the United States as in England, and the census figures of 1840 gave fairly exact evidence that a sensational reading revolution had taken place without any exhortation on the part of public moralists and social workers, but because the common people had the initiative and freedom to learn. In North Carolina, the worst situation of any state surveyed, 8 out of 9 could still read and write. In 1853, Per Siljeström, a Swedish visitor, wrote, "In no country in the world is the taste for reading so diffuse as among the common people in America. The American Almanac observed grandly, quote, periodical publications, especially newspapers, disseminate knowledge throughout all classes of society and exert an amazing influence in forming and giving effect to public opinion," close quote. It noted the existence of over 1,000 newspapers. In this nation of common readers, the spiritual longings of ordinary people shaped the public discourse. Ordinary people who could read, though not privileged by wealth, power, or position, could see through the fraud of social class or the even grander fraud of official expertise. That was the trouble. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. In his book, The New Illiterates, author Sam Blumenfeld gives us the best introduction to what went wrong with reading in the United States. He also gives us insight as to why learning to read needn't be frustrating or futile. A typical letter from one of his readers boasts of her success in imparting the alphabet code to 4 children under the age of 5 by the simple method of practice with letter sounds. One day she found her 3-year-old working his way through a lesson alone at the kitchen table reading S am Sam, M A N, man, and so on. Her verdict on the process: I had just taught him his letter sounds. He picked the rest up and did it himself. That's how simple it is. I know a school for kids ages 3 to 18 that doesn't teach anybody to read, yet everyone who goes there learns to do it, most very well. It's the beautiful Sudbury Valley School, 20 miles west of Boston, in the old Nathaniel Bowditch cottage, which looks suspiciously like a mansion, a place ringed by handsome outbuildings, a private lake, woods, and acres of magnificent grounds. Sudbury is a private school, but with a tuition under $4,000 a year, it's considerably cheaper than a seat in a New York City public school. At Sudbury, kids teach themselves to read. They learn at many different ages, even into the teen years, though that's rare. When each kid is ready, he or she self-instructs, if such a formal label isn't inappropriate for such a natural undertaking. During this time, they are free to request as much adult assistance as needed. That usually isn't much. In 30 years of operation, Sudbury has never had a single kid who didn't learn to read. All this is aided by a magnificent school library on open shelves where books are borrowed and returned on the honor system. About 65% of Sudbury kids go on to good colleges. The place has never seen a case of dyslexia. That's not to say some kids don't reverse letters and such from time to time, but such conditions are temporary and self-correcting, unless institutionalized into a disease. So Sudbury doesn't even teach reading, yet all its kids learn to read and even like reading. What could be going on there that we don't understand? The miracle woman who taught me to read was my mother, Booty. Booty never got a college degree, but nobody despaired about that because daily life went right along then without too many college graduates. Here was Booty's scientific method. She would hold me on her lap and read to me while she ran her finger under the words. That was it, except to read always with a lively expression in her voice and eyes, to answer my questions, and from time to time to give me some practice with different letter sounds. One thing more is important. For a long time, we would sing A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, and so on, every single day. We learned to love each letter. She would read tough stories as well as easy ones. Truth is, I don't think she could readily tell the difference any more than I could. The books had some pictures, but only a few. Words made up the center of attention. Pictures have nothing at all to do with learning to love reading, except too many of them will pretty much guarantee that it never happens. Over 50 years ago, my mother, Booty Zimmer, chose to teach me to read well. She had no degrees, no government salary, no outside encouragement, yet her private choice to make me a reader was my passport to a good and adventurous life. Booty, the daughter of a Bavarian printer, said nuts to the Prussian system. She voted for her own right to decide, and for that I will always be in her debt. She gave me a love of language, and it didn't cost much. Anybody could have the same if schooling hadn't abandoned its duty so flagrantly. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. The religious purpose of modern schooling was announced clearly by the legendary University of Wisconsin sociologist Edward A. Ross in 1901 in his famous book, Social Control. Your librarian should be able to locate a copy for you without much trouble. In it, Ed Ross wrote these words for his prominent following, quote, "Plans are underway to replace community, family, and church with propaganda, education, and mass media. The state shakes loose from the church, reaches out to school. People are only little plastic lumps of human dough," close quote. Social control revolutionized the discipline of sociology and had powerful effects on the other human sciences. In social science, it guided the direction of political science, economics, and psychology. In biology, it influenced genetics, eugenics, and psychobiology. It played a critical role in the conception and design of molecular biology. There you have it, in a nutshell, the whole problem with modern schooling. It rests on a nest of false premises. People are not little plastic lumps of dough. They are not blank tablets, as John Locke said they were. They are not machines, as Delametri hoped. Not vegetables, as Friedrich Froebel, inventor of kindergartens, hypothesized. Not organic mechanisms, as Wilhelm Wundt taught every psychology department in America at the turn of the century. Nor are they repertoires of behaviors, as Watson and Skinner wanted. They are not, as the new crop of systems thinkers would have it, mystically harmonious microsystems interlocking with grand macrosystems in a dance of atomic forces. I don't want to be crazy about this. Locked in a lecture hall or bull session, there's probably no more harm in these theories than reading too many Italian sonnets all at one sitting. But when each of these suppositions is sprung free to serve as a foundation for school experiments, it leads to frightfully oppressive practices. One of the ideas that empty child thinking led directly to was the notion that human breeding could be enhanced or retarded, as plant and animal breeding was, by scientific gardeners and husbandmen. Of course, the timescale over which this was plotted to happen was quite long. Nobody expected it to be like breeding fruit flies, but it was a major academic, governmental, and even military item, generously funded until Hitler's proactive program following America's lead grew so embarrassing by 1939 that our own projects and plans were made more circumspect. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, the monstrously influential Edward Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College said that school would establish conditions for, quote, selective breeding before the masses take things into their own hands, close quote. The religious purpose of modern schooling was embarrassingly evident back when Ross and Thorndike were on center stage. But they were surrounded by many like-minded friends. Another major architect of standardized testing, H.H. Goddard, said in his book Human Efficiency, 1920, that government schooling was about the perfect organization of the hive, close quote. He said standardized testing was a way to make lower classes recognize their own inferiority. Like wearing a dunce cap, it would discourage them from breeding and having ambition. Goddard was head of the psychology department at Princeton. So imagine the effect he had on the minds of doctoral candidates he coached, and there were hundreds. We didn't leave the religious purpose of modern schooling back in the early years of the century. In April of 1996, Al Shanker of the American Federation of Teachers said in his regular New York Times split-page advertisement that every teacher was really a priest. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Something strange is going on in schools and has been going on for quite some time. Whatever it is does not arise from the main American traditions. As closely as I can track the thing through the attitudes, practices, and stated goals of the shadowy crew who make a good living skulking around educational laboratories, think tanks, and foundations, we are experiencing an attempt, successful so far, to reimpose the strong state, strong social class attitudes of England and Germany on the United States, the very attitudes we threw off in the American Revolution. And in this counter-revolution, the state churches of England and Germany have been replaced by the secular church of forced government schooling. Advertising, public relations, and the stronger forms of quasi-religious propaganda are so pervasive in our schools, even in, quote, alternative schools, that independent judgment is suffocated in mass-produced secondary experiences and market-tested initiatives. Lifetime Learning Systems, one of the many new corporations formed to dig gold from our conditions of schooling, announced to its corporate clients, quote, "School is the ideal time to influence attitudes, build long-term loyalties, introduce new products, test market, promote sampling and trial usage, and above all, to generate immediate sales," close quote. Arnold Toynbee, the establishment's favorite historian in mid-20th century America, said in his monumental study of history that the original promise of universal education has been destroyed as soon as the school laws were passed, a destruction caused by, quote, "the possibility of turning education to account as a means of amusement for the masses," close quote, and a means of, quote, "profit for the enterprising persons by whom the amusement is purveyed," close quote. This opportunistic conversion quickly followed mass schooling's introduction when fantastic profit potential set powerful forces in motion. The bread of universal education is no sooner cast upon the water than a shoal of sharks arises from the depths and devours the children's bread under the educators' very eyes. In Toynbee's analysis, the dates speak for themselves. The edifice of universal education was, roughly speaking, completed in 1870, and the yellow press was invented 20 years later. As soon, that is, as the first generation of children from the national schools had acquired sufficient purchasing power, by a stroke of irresponsible genius, which had divined that the educational labor of love could be made to yield a royal profit. But vultures attending the inception of forced compulsion schooling attracted more ferocious predators. The commercial institutions that set about at once to prey on forced mass schooling attracted the attention of the rulers of modern national states. If press lords could make millions by providing idle amusement for the half-educated, serious statesmen could draw, not money perhaps, but power from the same source. The modern dictators have deposed the press lords and substituted for crude and debased private entertainment an equally crude and debased system of state propaganda. and I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Looking back on the original period of school formation in her study of American history textbooks, America Revised, Frances Fitzgerald remarked on the profound changes that emerged following suggestions issued by sociologists and social thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The original history of our institutions and the documents which protect our unique liberties gradually began to be effaced. Fitzgerald raises the puzzle of textbook alteration. Quote, "The ideology that lies behind these texts is rather difficult to define. It does not fit usual political patterns. The texts never indicate any line of action. Authors avoid what they choose to, and some of them avoid main issues. They fail to develop any original ideas. They confuse social sciences with science. Clouds of jargon leave out ideas. Historical names are given no character. They are cipher people. There are no conflicts, only problems. Close quote. Indeed, the texts may be unfathomable, and that may be the editorial intent. In 1982, Anthony Ettinger, a member of the private discussion group called the Council on Foreign Relations, asked an audience of communication executives this question: do we really have to have everybody literate, writing and reading in the traditional sense, when we have the means through our technology to achieve a new flowering of oral communication? Ettinger suggested, our idea of literacy is obsolete. 83 years earlier, John Dewey had written in The Primary Education Fetish that the plea for the predominance of learning to read in early school life because of the great importance attaching to literature seems to be a perversion. Close quote. For the balance of this discussion, I'm going to step into deeper water, first reviewing what reading in a Western alphabet really means, and what makes it a reasonably easy skill to transmit or to self-teach, and then tackling what happened to deprive the ordinary person of the ability to manage it very well. I want to first show you how, then answer the more speculative question, why. The National Adult Literacy Survey represents 190 million U.S. adults over age 16 with average school attendance of 12.4 years. The survey is conducted by the Educational Testing Service of Princeton, New Jersey. It ranks adult Americans into five levels. Here is its 1993 analysis. 42 million Americans over the age of 16 can't read. Some of this group can write their names on Social Security cards and fill in height, weight, and birth spaces on application forms. 50 million can recognize printed words on a fourth and fifth grade level. They cannot write simple messages or letters. 55 to 60 million are limited to sixth, seventh, and eighth grade reading. A majority of this group could not figure out the price per ounce of peanut butter in a 20-ounce jar costing $1.99 when they could round the answer off to a whole number. 30 million have 9th and 10th grade reading proficiency. This group, at all preceding, cannot understand a simplified written explanation of the procedures used by attorneys and judges in selecting juries. About 3.5% of the 26,000-member sample demonstrated literacy skills adequate to do traditional college study, a level 30% of all U.S. high school students reached in 1940, and which 30% of secondary students in other developed countries can reach today. This last fact alone should warn you how misleading comparisons drawn from international student competitions really are. Since the samples each country sends are small elite ones, unrepresentative of the entire student population. But behind the bogus superiority, a real one is concealed. 96.5% of the American population is mediocre to illiterate where deciphering print is concerned. This is no commentary on their intelligence, but without ability to take in primary information from print and to interpret it, they are at the mercy of commentators who tell them what things mean. A working definition of immaturity might include an excessive need for other people to interpret information for us. Certainly it's possible to argue that bad readers aren't victims at all, but perpetrators, cursed by their inferior biology to possess only shadows of intellect. That's what bell curve theory, evolutionary theory, aristocratic social theory, eugenics theory, strong state political theory, and some other kinds of theology are about. All agree most of us are inferior, if not downright dangerous. The integrity of such theoretical outlooks, at least where reading was concerned, took a stiff shot on the chin from America. Here, democratic practice allowed a revolutionary generation to learn how to read. Those granted the opportunity took advantage of it brilliantly. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. So how was the murder of American reading ability pulled off? I'll tell you in a second. But come back first to classical Greece, where the stupendous invention of the alphabet by Phoenicians was initially understood. The Phoenicians had an alphabetic language they used to keep accounts, but the Greeks were the first to guess correctly that revolutionary power could be unleashed by transcending mere lists, using written language for the permanent storage of analysis, exhortation, visions, and other things. After a period of experiment, the Greeks came up with a series of letters to represent sounds of their language. Like the Phoenicians, they recognized the value of naming each letter in a way distinct from its sound value, as every human being has a name distinct from his or her personality, as numbers have names for reference. Naming sounds rather than things was the breakthrough. While the number of things to be pictured is impossibly large, the number of sounds is strictly limited. In English, for example, most people only recognize 44. The problem, which American families once largely solved for themselves, is this. In English, a Latin alphabet has been imposed on a Germanic language with multiple non-Germanic borrowings, and it doesn't quite fit. Our 44 sounds are spelled 400-plus different ways. That sounds horrible. But in reality, in the hands of even a mediocre teacher, it's only annoying. In the hands of a good one, a thrilling challenge. Actually, 85% of the vast word stock of English can be read with knowledge of only 70 of the phonograms. A large number of the remaining irregularities seldom occur and can be remastered on an as-needed basis. Meanwhile, a whole armory of mnemonic tricks like "If a C I chance to spy, place the E before the I," exists to get new readers over the common humps. Inexpensive dictionaries, spell check typewriters, computers, and other technology are readily available these days to silently coach the fearful. But in my experience, that fear is neither warranted nor natural. Instead, it is engendered. Call it good business practice. Also, communicating abstractions in picture language is a subtlety requiring more time and training to master than is available for most of us. Greeks could organize ambitious concepts abstractly in written language, communicating accurately with each other over space and time much more readily than their competitors. According to Mitford Matthews, the secret of their phenomenal advance was in their conception of the nature of a word. They reasoned that words were sounds or combinations of ascertainable sounds, and they held inexorably to the basic proposition that writing, properly executed, was a guide to sound reading. A number of other good treatments are available for the newcomer. Close quote. Learning sound sight correspondence first comes in alphabetic language. Competence with the entire package of sounds corresponding to alphabet symbols comes quickly. After that, anything can be read, and its meaning inquired after. The substantial speaking vocabulary kids bring to school, 6,000 to 10,000 words, can now be read at once and understood. When the Romans got the alphabet through the Etruscans, they lost the old letter names, so they invented new ones, making them closer to the letter sounds. This was a significant mistake which causes confusion in novice readers even today. Through conquest, the Latin alphabet spread to the languages of Europe. Rome's later mutation into the universal Christian Church caused Latin, the language of church liturgy, to flow into every nook and cranny of the former empire. The Latin alphabet was applied to the English language by Christian missionaries in the 7th century. While it fused with spoken English, this was far from a perfect fit. There were no single letters to stand for certain sounds. Scribes had to scramble to combine letters to approximate sounds that had no companion letter. This matching process was complicated over centuries by repeated borrowings from other languages and by certain massive sound shifts which still occupy scholars in trying to explain. Before the spread of printing in the 16th century, not being able to read wasn't much of a big deal. There wasn't much to read. The principal volume available was the Bible, from which appropriate bits were read aloud by religious authorities during worship and on ceremonial occasions. Available texts were in Latin or Greek, but persistent attempts to provide translations was a practice thought to contain much potential for schism. An official English Bible, the Authorized King James Version, appeared in 1611, preempting all competitors in a bold stroke which changed popular destiny. Instantly, the Bible became a universal textbook, offering insights both delicate and powerful, a vibrant cast of characters, brilliant verbal pyrotechnics and more to the humblest rascal who could read. Talk about a revolutionary awakening for ordinary people. The Bible was it, thanks to the dazzling range of models it provided in the areas of exegesis, drama, politics, psychology, characterization, plus the formidable reading skills it took to grapple with the Bible. A little more than three decades after this translation, the English king was deposed and beheaded. The connection was direct. Nothing would ever be the same again, because too many good readers had acquired the proclivity of thinking for themselves. The magnificent enlargement of imagination and voice that the Bible's exceptional catalog of language and ideas made available awakened in ordinary people a powerful desire to read in order to read the holy book without a priest's mediation. Strenuous efforts were made to discourage this, but the Puritan Revolution and Cromwell's interregnum sent literacy surging. Nowhere was it so accelerated as in the British colonies of North America, a place already far removed from the royal voice. Printing technology emerged. Like the computer in our own day, it was quickly incorporated into every corner of daily life. But there were still frequent jailings, whippings, and confiscations for seditious reading, as people of substance came to realize how dangerous literacy could be. Reading offered many delights, cravings to satisfy curiosity about this Shakespeare fellow, or to dabble in the musings of Lord Bacon or John Locke were now not difficult to satisfy. Spelling and layout were made consistent. Before long, prices of books dropped. All this activity intensified pressure on illiterate individuals to become literate. The net result of printing and Protestantism, which urged communicants to go directly to the word, eliminating the priestly middleman, stimulated the spread of roving teachers and small proprietary and church schools. A profession arose to satisfy demand for a popular way to understand what uses to make of books, and from this, a demand to understand many things. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The first schoolman to seriously challenge what is known today as phonics was Friedrich Gedecky, a disciple of Rousseau, director of a well-known gymnasium in Prussia. In 1791, he published the world's first Look-Say Primer, a children's reader without the ABCs and spelling. The idea was to eliminate drill. Kids would learn through pictures, following suggestions the legendary mystic and scholar Comenius set down in his famous Orbis Pictus of 1657. After a brief splash and three editions, the fashion vanished for an excellent reason. As good as it sounds in theory, it doesn't work well at all in practice. Though here and there exceptions are encountered, and infuriatingly enough, it can seem to work in the early years of first and second grade. Soon after that, the rapidly developing reading power in phonetically trained children makes them capable of recognizing in print their entire speaking and listening vocabulary, while look-say-trained readers can read without error only the words they have memorized as whole shapes, a relative handful. This is devilishly complex terrain. Gedecky's theory held that when enough words are ingested and recognized, the student can figure out for himself the 70 key phonograms of the English language. Indeed, this is the only credible explanation which could account for the well-known phenomenon of children who teach themselves to read handily without the use of any system at all. I have no doubt children occasionally learn to read this way. Yet, if true, how do we account for the grotesque record of whole word instruction over a century and a half in every conceivable school setting? Money, time, attention, and caring adults in profusion all have been available to make this alternative method work to teach reading proficiency, yet its record in competition with the old-fashioned alphabet system is horrifying. What might account for this? I have a hunch based on a decade of ruminating. Since no one has yet bothered to assemble a large group of self-taught good readers to ask them how it happened, let my hunch serve as a working hypothesis for you to chew upon at your leisure. Consider the matter of time. The average 5-year-old can master all of the 70 phonograms in 6 weeks. At that point, he can read just about anything fluently. Can he understand everything? No, of course not. But also, no synthetic barrier to understanding is being interposed by weird-looking words to be memorized whole, either. Paulo Freire taught ignorant campesinos with no tradition of illiteracy at all to read in 30 hours. They were adults with different motivations than children, but when he showed them a sentence and they realized it said, "The land belongs to the tiller," they were hooked. That's Jesuit savvy for you. Back to this matter of time. By the end of the 4th grade, phonics-trained students are at ease with an estimated 24,000 words. Whole-word-trained students have memorized about 1,600 words and can successfully guess at some thousands more, but also unsuccessfully guess at thousands too. One reigning whole-word expert has called reading a psycholinguistic guessing game, in which the reader is not extracting the writer's meaning, but constructing a meaning of his own. While there is an attractive side to this that is ignored by critics of whole language, and I number myself among these, the value doesn't begin to atone for the theft of priceless reading time and guided practice. As long as whole language kids are retained in a hothouse environment, shielded from linguistic competition, things seem idyllic. But once mixed together with phonetically trained kids of similar age and asked to avail themselves of the intellectual treasure locked up in words, the result is not so pretty. Either the deficient kid must retreat from the field with a whopping sense of inferiority, or worse, he must advance aggressively into the fray, claiming books are overrated, that thinking and judgment are merely matters of opinion. The awful truth is that circumstances hardly give us the luxury of testing Gedecky's hypothesis about kids being able to deduce the rules of language from a handful of words. Humiliation makes mincemeat of most of them long before the trial is fairly joined. So the second hunch I have is that where whole word might work when it works at all, is in a comfortable, protected environment without people around to laugh derisively at the many wretched mistakes you must make on the way to becoming a Columbus of language. But in case you hadn't noticed, schools aren't safe places for the young to guess at meanings of things. Only an imbecile would pretend that school isn't a pressure cooker of psychodrama. Wherever children are gathered into groups by compulsion, a pecking order soon emerges in which malice, mockery, intimidation of the weak, envy, and a whole range of other nasty characteristics hold sway, like the famous mill pond of Huxley's, whose quiet surface mirroring fall foliage conceals a murderous subterranean world whose law is eat or be eaten. That's melodramatic, I suppose. Yet 30 classroom years, And a decade more as a visitor in hundreds of other schools have shown me what a meat grinder the peaceful classroom really is. Bill is wondering whether he will be beaten again on the way to the lunchroom. Molly is paralyzed with fear that the popular Jean will make loud fun of her prominent teeth. Ronald is digging the point of a sharpened pencil into the neck of Herbert, who sits in front of him, all the while whispering he will get Herb good if he gets Ron in trouble with the teacher. Alan is snapping a rubber band at Flo. Ralph is about to call Leonard trailer park trash for the 300th time that day, not completely clear he knows what it means, yet enjoying the anguish it brings to Leonard's face. Greta, the most beautiful girl in the room, is practicing ogling Shire boys, then cutting them dead when she evokes any hopeful smiles in response. Willie is slowly shaken down for a dollar by Phil. And Mary's single mom has just received an eviction notice. Welcome to another day in an orderly scientific classroom. Teacher may have a permanent simper pasted on her face, but it's deadly serious, the world she presides over, a bad place to play psycholinguistic guessing games, which involves sticking one's neck out in front of classmates as the rules of language are empirically derived. A method that finds mistakes to be charming stabs in the right direction, maybe onto something person to person or in the environment of a loving home, but it's dynamically unsuited to the forge of forced schooling. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Gatto taught for 30 years in the New York City schools and resigned to become an advocate of self-directed learning and homeschooling. You can learn more about his work at johntaylorgatto.com. G-A-T-T-O, that's how it's spelled. The music featured in this week's program was by Ethan Miller and Kate Boverman. More on their work can be found at riotfolk.org. And if you'd like to hear this show again or share it with others, this and all of our previous shows are archived on the web in MP3 and podcast format at unwelcomeguests.org. You can also send emails. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the material in the program. Our theme music, The Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.